Once more under the breach, dear friends.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And, you know, I've often wondered about the level of intelligence we have. We think we're pretty smart, but
I think
the challenge of having all the software and hardware in here, as complex as it is, and having it changed on a regular basis, and to seeing if we can, excuse the term, find the cheese after they've moved it in the maze and how long it takes us to do it, is a definite indication that we're smart enough to continue to function.
Maybe.
I don't know.
I don't know if we've met the test. Survival of the fittest may not be us.
Well, I flew a flight simulator of a Boeing 737 and was able to fly it and land it successfully, and I can tell you it's nowhere near as complicated as what's in front of you right now. Anyway, this is the Personal Wealth Coach, and we've got some disclosures here. The Personal Wealth Coach is not just a radio program. It's also the name of an SEC-registered investment advisory firm in Salado, Texas. Not to say that the SEC approves or disapproves of anything we do or don't do. They just are the regulators that regulate us and inspect us and so on. We give investment advice to relatively high net worth people. We're what's called a wealth management organization. And this is not investment advice, even though we're one and the same. We are different when we're here. This is educational and should not be construed to be investment advice. Investment advice has to do with your individual circumstances. And believe it or not, we don't know your individual circumstances.
How's that for weird?
Well, it is, because all we can tell is we're talking to a couple of phone balls. The other thing is that the information we present educationally on this radio program has been obtained from normally reliable and reputable sources. We don't just pull stuff off of free sites on the internet and talk about it. But we don't warranty or guarantee any of the information we present as being accurate, and it should not be used for investment decisions. Boy, that's a strange thing, because people are going to use it anyway. What else?
Well, they'll use it, but they'll at least be informed that the education is just that, not us telling them to do one thing or the other.
The other thing is we have a telephone number in here, and you can call and ask questions and make comments and whatever you want to, presuming that this is the middle of December. It's December 15th where you are, 2018, and you're welcome to give us a call at 254-773-1400. And we also take email messages at either jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com.
Right.
And we're not actually required as followers, I know, to say that Town Square Media's opinions and ours may be different. I'm not sure that Town Square Media has an opinion.
I don't know if they have an opinion or not, but that's just my opinion.
It's just your opinion that their opinions are different from our opinion?
Yeah, my opinion says so.
Okay. Well, we had a week.
And that, sir, is a fact.
And I like the Barron's Trader column. The headline sums it up: all three stock indexes hit correction territory, although that probably should be indices.
Well, that's how you say it.
Oh, okay.
I say indexes.
Okay. And
I have two index fingers. I call them indexes. I don't call them indices.
That makes sense. The S&P 500 is the index we follow more than we do the others. And it's down 52 weeks. It's down 2.84. Year to date, it's down 2.76. Those are getting pretty close together. As a matter of fact, at the end of this month, we think the 52 weeks and the year to date probably will align.
Whoa.
Which they only do once a year.
Yeah, it's like being a stop clock is right twice a day. Well, the 52 week and 1 year readings, year to date readings and 52 week readings are right once a year.
Right. And the S&P 500 closed at 2599.95,
yes,
which is really close to 2600, but not quite to 2600.
You've got 0.05 to go.
Right.
Don't round up here.
Right. Round up? Never mind. I won't go there.
Let's not get into Montana.
The S&P 500 was at 24,100. I mean, the Dow was at 24,100. I kind of go out there and get my mind stuck on certain numbers and use those as anchors. For example, I remember back in September, was it August or September? I don't remember which. The S&P 500 hit 2929, and that kind of stuck in memory. It actually got up to 2930.64 or something on another day. But 2929 is a good number to remember. That was its high point. And since then, it's down about 11.25%. That distinctly puts it in what we call correction territory, since 10% is correction.
But wait, before we move beyond that, let me just say, when it comes to word meanings, and it comes to, for instance, the bear market, the correction, there is no, what is it that Al Gore said? No supervising authority?
Something legal authority.
So there's no overriding legal authority, something like that. There's no person or entity out there that says that
controlling legal authority.
There you go. There's no controlling definition authority for correction or for bear. It's just loosely held that a correction is 10% and bear is 20%.
It's a cumulative collective.
It's a consensus opinion.
It's a cumulative collective consensus.
But when people in the media say this bear market, and they're talking about a correction, you can't even pull out Webster's dictionary and wave it at them, because Webster's hasn't really come out and said one way or the other.
I can pull out Investopedia.com and
Investopedia. Yeah,
Investopedia.com and say, ah, look here, Investopedia disagrees with you.
Right. But
and
they're not as up to date as they could be either.
Right. So
we're in correction territory.
What's a correction? Well, a correction means the market overshot itself. It rose too much. And that's the story. I like the Barron's Trader column today is really insightful. Sometimes it's just, but this time it's really insightful. The bottom line to it is, last year, and I went back and checked, at this point, we had about a 20% gain for the year.
Which we should call the opposite of a bear. Mm-hmm. That should be a bull market.
Right. Why is a bear the opposite of a bull?
Do you want to go into that?
I do.
But we can go into
why are two animals...
Shall we say it?
Go ahead.
Okay, the concept of why the bear and the bull are opposites to each other.
You know this. I did. I wrote it.
Yes, you wrote the paper, you wrote the book, and I have verified this. This is early markets were fair markets. They were going to the fairs, Scarborough Fair, all the fairs.
And the value there was the fair market value.
Right, and that's the value that you got at the fair, was the fair market value. Fair didn't mean even balanced. That came 200 years later with the reference to the scales. The fair scales were fair, and therefore...
Well, they were the king. The king actually had inspectors at the fairs to make sure the scales were
or the count, or whoever licensed it. Yeah.
Well, generally, it was under the authority of the king.
Right. So in a good year, lots of crops, lots of game in the woods. The animals were running around, so you were able to feed a lot more of your cattle and your pigs. And you only need one bull in your herd. So they would bring their bulls to market. And they still celebrate this annually in Spain with the running of the bulls. So
that's a bunch of bull.
It is a bunch of bull. The bad news on the other side is when the weather's not been good, crops are not good, well, it also means that the animals in the woods are not doing well, and the predators in the woods get hungry, and so they start wandering out of the woods and attacking the livestock. And bears were one of the major culprits here. So there were people that would go and round up the bears. They would trap the bears and bring them to the market bear baiting.
We're back to Roundup again.
Yes, it's Roundup one more time. Roundup for the bears. So they'd bring the bears in. They bait them with dogs, and that if you had a lot of bears at the market, it was definitely a bear market. It was the one good thing about a bear market was the bears. You got to watch the bears be tortured to death.
Right.
I guess that was a good thing back then. But
and there were a lot of bear skins.
Yeah, there were a lot of bear skins. That's right. Not torturing or bear trap.
Anyway,
that's the concept. Why bear is the opposite of bull.
Well, this is a correction, meaning a correction is when the market overshoots fair value and then drops back to or below fair value. That's generally something in excess of 10%, but not as much as 20%. And that's in many ways exactly what happened. The market at present, by our estimates, has dropped a little below its historic norms. It certainly could drop some more. But bear markets, on the other hand, begin in every time I have been able to find one anywhere, begin with rather impressive excesses, where there are at least quite a number of stocks in the market that are trading at absurd, a large number of stocks normally trading at absurd valuations.
Yeah, and before the downturn, Amazon was definitely one of those. So.
Well, it went down all by separately. Yeah,
yeah, it went down separately. It was kind of the leading of the downturn. Yeah.
But, for example, in the FANGs, Apple has not been overpriced.
FANGs, by the way, is Facebook, Apple, Netflix,
Alphabet,
Google.
Alphabet, Google.
Well, Alphabet is Google. So Netflix and Google was before they went to Alphabet. Now,
and what's the S stand for? No, just, yeah, anyway.
It's just FANG.
It's just plural. Anyway, basically some high-tech stocks that definitely got overpriced and are still, in many cases, overpriced by our reckoning. But if you think
by other people's reckoning, they're not overpriced.
If you think that they're going to change the entire world, you probably don't think they're overpriced. Now, the banks, on the other hand, are in what we call bear market territory.
Yeah.
Some of the largest investment banks on Wall Street are down over 20%.
This is kind of the big part of that.
We can get into that as to why that's happened separately.
The financial sector took off after the president was elected. So if you think of 2017, yes, those glorious times, the golden time of 2017 when the market was going like gangbusters, if you think back to that, to the end of 2016, after the election, the stocks that took off the first were the financial stocks. And they have had this big boost throughout 2017. We had a big tax cut. Corporate tax rates are down. Interest rates are up. Banks are more profitable by almost any way of measurement. The price of a lot of those financial stocks is now down below what it was before the president was elected. That tells you something about whether or not we overcorrected for the correction.
And this doesn't bear any of the historic hallmarks of a bear market, meaning that bear markets begin on
pessimism.
No, bear markets begin. Bear markets begin on.
On optimism. Okay. All right. So you're mixing up the quote.
No, I'm just bringing in the end of the quote that you're so familiar with.
Yeah,
bull markets begin on pessimism. We have a lot of that.
Mature on optimism and die on euphoria.
Well, we don't have any euphoria, and I haven't heard much optimism lately.
No, if you look at the media, almost any direction on the news media, what you're going to find is that we're at peak pessimism as far as the media is concerned.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm turning a knob over here because we are hitting into the red with our voices, but we're not hearing it very well on our headsets.
It's got a clipper.
Yeah.
Anyway, the point is that we got a correction going on. We have a negative return so far for the year. We had a big positive return last year, and Barron's in this same column, the trader column, at this point last year was saying the market has overshot, that we have too much gain. Now, note, however, that as we came into the beginning of last year, over the last 12 months, U.S. corporations in the S&P 500 have averaged a 20% gain in earnings.
Not in stock price. Right now, the stock price is negative.
Yeah, the stock price is down. Earnings are up 20%. Now, 10% of that, roughly, 10 to 12% of that earnings rise.
Tax cut.
Was the tax cut, which shouldn't be included in there as permanent because that's a one-shot deal, even though we're going to be paying for it for a long time.
You don't see that growth in revenue continuing on. You just maintain that at a certain level.
Well, not just revenue, growth in profits.
Right.
And so as we go into the coming year, if you felt like at the beginning of last year, the market was fairly priced, and I kind of tend to think it was, then we are sitting probably 8% below historic fair market value already. Now, because we've had rise in earnings, a decline in the price-to-earnings ratio in the S&P 500, but we're just having a correction. Why are we having a correction?
Yeah, and the other end of that, why aren't we having a bear? If this is a correction, why isn't it a bear?
Well, first off, the economy is not indicating we should be having a bear market. The economy is roaring along very nicely. There are a couple of things out there that are worrisome, which is how bull markets climb a wall of worry.
Right.
And we've been talking in the middle of bull markets.
Yeah, we've been talking about this for about a year and a half, about logistical bottlenecks. Well, but that's a limiter on growth. It's not something that causes shrinkage immediately.
The surveys done by several different sources, Wall Street Journal, Barron's, Financial Times, The Economist, and Bloomberg, among others, are coming up with the same results. Both in the American Association of Individual Investors, which, by the way, their membership is 49% bearish right now, which is indications that we should be entering into a bull market before long. And the professionals and the institutional investors all are pretty much saying the same thing. There is some tremendous uncertainty going forward. And the uncertainty, the first issue in the uncertainty is tariffs. If indeed the Trump administration, 90 days from now, or he could just do it at any point because he said he's not locked in any way to a 90-day ceasefire in the trade war. If the Trump administration decided to suddenly impose 25% tariffs on everything coming out of China, it would create the beginnings of a major trade war that could be very damaging to profitability for American corporations across the board. Virtually every major corporation in the S&P 500 is in some way linked to China for profitability. So that's number one. That's their number one concern. Number two concern is that the rest of the world looks like it's gone basically flat. Its growth rate has fallen off. Now, when we say going basically flat, the Chinese gross domestic product appears to be growing at about 6.6% for 2018, which would be just absolutely knockout wonderful in the United States. But consider that China is still a developing country.
That's a pretty slow growth rate for a developing country.
And China's individual productivity per citizen is lower than Mexico's. They still use oxen there because they've got a lot of room to grow. But they're also hitting constraints caused by their infrastructure, just like we are. And the tariffs may be having some small effect on them. It isn't much because their exports are up. But the point is, there's two major concerns, well, actually three out there. One, the imposition of 25% tariffs could be damaging to 2019 profitability for S&P 500 company for corporations in the United States. Could be severely damaging. Number two is that the rest of the world looks like it has peaked in this economic cycle and maybe headed back downhill. The Germans actually turned in some negative numbers this last month when it comes to industrial production. Then the third one is interest rates, and that is the booger bear that's got them worried. And the reason is, year over year, the Labor Department disclosed Friday, wages are up 3.1%. Now, that's not compensation. That's a different issue. Wages, the money that people get and take home, and after paying their taxes, they get to spend that money, are up 3.1%. Spending, on the other hand, over the last 3 months by consumers is up 6-point-something%. That's why the economy is booming and just going like mad, is we have a tremendous growth in spending, a growth in wages, and there's when the Labor Department surveys companies, they find out that they are having a heck of a time trying to find good people to hire, and they're willing to pay more, and they're starting to pay more. And when people are getting paid more money to do the same thing, they have more money to spend, and the companies then in turn pass that along in the form of increased prices, and
that's inflation.
Inflation, which means the Fed needs to keep raising rates. So even the most optimistic Fed watchers are seeing a rate rise this year, this month, from the Fed of 0.25%. That'll take us from two and a quarter, two and a half, and then the most optimistic people out there are seeing two more quarter point raises in 2019. Some are seeing four. So that would raise it to 3.25%. Now, at 3.25%, that would put the interbank rate higher than the 10-year Treasury, the dreaded inverted yield curve, which is why banks are in a bear market. Now,
all right.
I'll go into that if you'd like me
to. What I would like to do is go back and make this all understandable.
Oh, boy.
That's what we just said, that whole long soliloquy. Most of you listened to that and nodded your head and gathered a lot of information from it, but the totality of it didn't make any sense. How does what the Fed does affect you? How does what is a dreaded inverted yield curve? All of that stuff. So let's take a step back.
The dreaded.
Yes. What is the Fed doing when it raises an interest rate? First, it's an interbank lending rate. What is that? Well, the Federal Reserve Act said to banks that you're going to be regulated, in essence, by yourselves, but the president is going to nominate some folks that will be approved by the Senate with advice and consent, and those people will be in charge of regulating how much in the way of reserves the banks keep on hand. It's Christmas time, so this is, you know, Jimmy Stewart time of year. If you think about It's a Wonderful Life and you think about the run on the savings and loan, the reason why we don't have much in the way of runs on the bank anymore is because the Federal Reserve has a requirement that the banks don't invest all the money that they have on deposit. If you show up and you say, give me my money in my bank account, they have it, at least a big portion of their depositors' money, immediately available to give to you because that's their job. The Federal Reserve raises a lending rate. So this will be helpful, hopefully, for a lot of people that are confused about how banks work. If you've ever been to a bank at 3:15 and the doors are closed and locked and they say, we're closed at 3:15? Why are you closed at 3:15? Now, and people joke about bankers' hours. They're not really closed. They're closed to the public. And this goes back way, way, way pre-computer, when computers were a person's job rather than a machine. At a bank, consider it's a relatively large branch in a city. And they've got lots of loan officers. And during the day, they're doing what banks do, which hopefully is give loans. That's how they make their profits. So they're giving out these loans.
Well, that's how they used to make profits.
Right.
The big banks
now
make profits.
Now they're just charging fees.
Now the big banks make profits by trading, or used to anyway.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so these loans are being written out. This is a very basic concept. This is the reason why the Federal Reserve exists. The loans are being written out. And the rule is you can't write out so many loans. That's how they invest the money, is they write a loan to somebody at a higher interest rate than what they're giving to their depositors. What money are they using? Well, they're using the deposit money. So they're not supposed to use it all up, because if you show up and say, give me my money, they've got to give it to you. Well, they traditionally have closed at 3 o'clock so they could make sure that all of their loan officers didn't loan out more than their reserve amount. If they dipped into their reserves, they have to immediately fill that money back up, which means they start calling other Federal Reserve banks. They part of the Federal Reserve network. They call up and they say, hey, we need a loan. This is why they call it the interbank lending rate, because they're getting loans from other banks to make sure that their reserve has been met. And they can actually go directly to the Federal Reserve. And they're charged at the interest rate that the Federal Reserve is tweaking up and down as they go about their business. So recently it's been an upward movement. The Federal Reserve is basically saying to banks, if you overloan, if you put too many loans out there, it's going to cost you more. Your interest rate that you're being charged on that is going to be more expensive. So they raise the interest rate. If there's still a lot of money out there being loaned out for long term, even though the short term money, that overnight, and you got to make sure your reserves are met, has a higher interest rate. If people are still loaning out money at the higher interest, or at the higher time period. So, and it's at a lower interest rate. What they're saying is, whoa, we got to stop making loans because it costs us too much money for too much time.
Yeah. In other words, if you go to the bank and the bank is paying, because the interbank rate is 3%, so that's, let's say they're paying you 3% on your deposited money, wherever it is.
Right.
And they're only able to make loans, because the 10-year treasury rate is at 3%, they're only able to make loans at like maybe 4%, and it costs them money to do business, and some of those loans are going to go bad, and
right.
by the time they figure it in, they really are getting less than 3% on the car loans and the personal loans
right.
and so on.
So they're losing money if they make a long-term loan, which is the dreaded right. yield inversion. That's when the long-term rates are lower than the shorter-term rates.
And as a result, the bank has to stop loaning money.
And that slows down the economy hugely.
And that means businesses can't buy new equipment and a lot of things go on. So what's happened?
You can't buy a house, you can't buy a
right.
car, or it's harder and harder to buy a house and a car because they're just not going to give you the loan.
And that's the reason that the major banks, Goldman Sachs and so on, are down 20%, where the market is down 10%. Very simply, as people look at the longer term interest rates, as the shorter term interest rates go up and the longer term interest rates go down, because the Treasury has now dropped below 3%.
Now, why is it, you know,
the 10-year Treasury?
Right. Why is it that the Fed is culpable here? It isn't. The reason why the interest rates are moving down long-term and up short-term has a much larger gorilla in the room than the Fed. The Fed's a big gorilla, don't get me wrong. They are a huge mover in the markets.
Mm-hmm.
The federal government is bigger.
Oh, yeah.
And all of that new debt that you're hearing about on any news station about new debt being amassed and that we're going to be above $1 trillion in deficit and maybe it's $1.3 trillion, and we wrote in the newsletter, what is it, that we're up 54% over the deficit from last year.
Yeah.
All of
well,
that,
actually 51%.
A large portion of that debt is being borrowed at the short-term window. They're saying, I'm going to keep this in the two-year area. Why? Well, traditionally, that's been the lower interest rate. But if you suck up all of the money that's available for short-term loans, the interest rate goes up. It's supply and demand. If there's a lot of people that want to give you a loan, you're going to get a low interest rate. If there's a lot of people that want a loan and not a lot of people giving loans, the interest rates go up. So short-term interest rates are going up. The federal government is sucking up all that money. And there's not enough people willing to give loans in the short term, so interest rates start up. It's attracting more people to the shorter term
right.
rates. And this is another story here I want to touch on that has to do with this.
Anyway.
Robinhood.
Robinhood?
It's a investment firm. It's a brokerage firm.
Robinhood is an brokerage firm.
Yeah, it's a new startup. It's being funded Silicon Valley style. And they just offered a short-term interest rate, a really high short-term interest rate. And it has attracted the attention suddenly of the regulators. So before you hear about this short-term interest rate being really high and you get all excited about it, because they've got a lot of people that are on in their court. Ashton Kutcher is tweeting about them because he's an investor. And they just announced a short-term, and do not act on this, by the way, folks. I'm telling you this, this is news. Don't do it. There's a lot of danger here.
Well, look.
They just offered what they say is bank accounts, checking accounts at 3%.
Well,
let me hit what the problem is.
Okay.
These are not bank accounts, number one. Bank accounts are FDIC insured. These accounts are not. They're calling them checking and savings accounts. They are not. They're advertising that they have Securities Investor Protection Corporation coverage, SIPC. The problem with that is that the president of the SIPC just said to the media yesterday, we only cover money used for the purchase of securities. That's stocks and bonds.
They cover up to $500,000. I mean,
in
up
cash,
to $250,000
in cash when it's available to be used to purchase securities.
Ah,
that's a very clear statement. It has to be available to be used to purchase securities. It has to be one of the reasons that it exists there. So it's important to know this stuff, because the advertisement from Robinhood is you don't have to invest in anything. So the president of the SIPC is saying, I don't think we cover that. If they don't have a primary purpose of those accounts as the ability to buy securities, we don't cover it. If you say you don't have to do that, we don't cover it. Now, the reality is, if you have a money market account in a brokerage firm, it's available to be used to buy securities. The problem with this whole statement...
Well, actually, if it's an actual money market brokerage account, it is securities.
Right.
So you have bought securities
right.
with them.
Here's the problem here. Robinhood has stated in its filings that they're buying U.S. government treasuries on the short-term two-year area with this money that's coming in. And this sounds complicated, but it's not really. They're offering 3%, but the U.S. government treasuries for the same time period are paying 2.4%, which means that the firm itself is coming up with 0.6% to pay these depositors. That's clearly not covered by the SIPC. So I'm saying that because we're talking about the short-term rates. If a institution is offering a short-term rate that is much higher, then the banks that you see, don't jump on it immediately. Check into it. Check if it's covered. In this particular case, the advertisements have SIPC stamped all over them, even though the SIPC is saying, nope, that's not us. We're not doing that.
Well, you know, investing, by definition, the people who invest in Robinhood are relatively well off.
Well, investing in the company. But what if you're using them to invest in the market?
You're still relatively well off, or you wouldn't be investing in the market. No, I'm just saying.
They got 549,000 new applications in a one-month period for their checking and savings accounts. So those are with air quotes over them.
No, when I say relatively well off, a middle class, okay?
They have a bank account. They're attracting millennials. These are not the well-off folks.
They are, by your definition.
Well, if you're living in India, they are very well off.
They're not poverty-stricken.
Okay. Yeah, they are not starving.
You would not say they were poor.
Yes, I would not.
Robinhood, by definition, takes from the rich and gives to the poor.
So why would you, if you're not poor, be putting money at Robinhood? That you might be. Well, I think that's the definition of.
Well, no, it's kind of like giving your money to somebody whose name is Madoff. So, and be surprised when he made off with your money.
Now, I am not saying that Robinhood is about to fail. I'm not about to say that. What I am saying is that when you invest your money, when you put your money somewhere and you're chasing the difference between 2.4% and 3%, you may be putting yourself in danger to try to get a rate at a guaranteed amount that's above what is guaranteed by most banks. And the last piece of this to wrap it up is not very long ago, at least in my career, it was only about 4 years ago, people were saying, I have short-term money and the bank's not paying me very much on this. What's the best interest rates being paid out there for banks? And do you know which territory was offering that?
Well, not bank. Well, yeah, Puerto Rico.
Puerto Rico. Puerto Rico's banks were in the process of failing. Puerto Rico as a territorial government was determining when it was going to default on its debts. So when somebody's offering you free money, in essence, there better be something attached to it to say that it's real. Because why would they give you money that they don't have to?
And there is a very fundamental reality. The higher the guaranteed interest rate or fixed interest rate on something, the greater the risk of failure.
Yes.
And anything very
The higher above the average of other guarantees.
Just the higher. I mean, if the issue is that, well, yeah, I guess when compared with the no-risk Treasury security.
Right, right. Because in the 1970s and 80s, we had really, really high interest rates, but that didn't mean the government was going to default on it.
Right. The issue is that you just don't need to be chasing high interest rates with savings. Savings, this is a key element.
It means safe.
savings are designed to avoid loss, not to make money. And people try to make money and avoid loss at the same time. Man, that is, throughout my 35 years of doing this, I can tell you, can't even begin to count the number of people who basically believe that there was such a thing as wealth without risk. By the way, there was a book written by a guy who is now, I think, wearing an orange jumpsuit. It was very, very popular. He had a radio program. He had an investment firm. And the name of the book was Wealth Without Risk. He, at one point, was in prison. He was a felon. But even when he wrote the book and he was had a radio show and TV show syndicated, the guy had been banned from the securities industry for fraud. And there is no such thing as wealth without risk. What happens is you choose your risk. If you put your money in CDs, your risk of immediate loss drops effectively to zero. But your long-term risk...
Looks like he was sued.
Well, he actually he was banned from the securities industry, and I know at one point he was charged with felony fraud. I don't know where that came out. And I know that he was a less than that, and he disappeared off the horizon suddenly. And I know there's a bankruptcy filing at some point. But at any rate,
he had to pay $14 million in a lawsuit, and there's a series of other things. But I can't find him being banned. It might be there.
Yeah, he was at the time in the position to, if FINRA had banned, well, the NASD at the time had banned him from securities industry for life.
All right. Well, we have a caller on 773-1400. That's 254-773-1400. Caller, you are on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. I was just going to ask you, if you're traveling from the United States to other countries, you know, France, Thailand, Mexico, wherever you want to go, and you have American money with you and you want to change it to their currency, how do they go about doing this? Okay, if your currency is worth more than theirs, do they kind of give you more money of theirs than what you have of theirs? I'm just trying to figure that part out. Thank you, sir.
All right. Thanks for the call. That's a decent question. When you get to another country, number one, you've got to declare if you're carrying more than $10,000 in cash. That's clear. You got to do it on your custom forms or they can take it from you. You're allowed to take it. You're allowed to put as much money on your person as you want. You can carry millions if you want. You just have to tell them you're doing it. You have to declare it on the form. That's really important, folks. Don't mess up on that. Don't do it because you don't think it's their business, because it will become their business and not yours anymore. Or yours in a very complicated way. Once you get where you're going, whether that's Jamaica or Mexico, France, Denmark, Thailand, doesn't matter, there are currency exchanges, and they're usually right there at the airport. These exchanges in Europe, they're everywhere because people come from all over the place to go to Europe. I mean, they're exchanging the foreign and the yuan and so a lot of other things into euros there or into pounds. These exchanges are for-profit enterprises. So let's do, we're going to do some completely imaginary currencies so that people don't think I'm trying to, say, get into the foreign exchange market, because I'm not. That's a danger of its own. So you show up with, what's a good fake name for some currency?
The Gidget.
Okay, you got some Gidgets. And you want to convert them to, what's another one, into guineas. Guineas.
Well, no, guineas.
Gidgets
are,
to guineas.
Guineas are a real...
They used to be. They're not really used.
It's a slang term for the pound.
Okay. Bucks to guineas. How's that? We're going to change bucks to guineas. These are not dollars and pounds.
I think there are actually guineas someplace, but that's all right.
Okay, so we've got this conversion going on. Say there are $2 required in the exchange rate to buy one guinea, two bucks for one guinea. Are you going to pay $2 for one guinea? No, you're going to pay a commission to the exchange, to the transfer agent. They're going to sit there. You're going to give them $2, and they say, I'm going to require 15 pennies for my fee. And they usually don't have they usually have a minimum that you have to do, or the price goes way up for their commission. If they're going to charge you $5 to do it, you don't want to convert $5 because you'll lose the whole thing in the commission. Basically, what it is that people have stacks of money in the different currencies, and they're willing to transfer it to you, but they have to make a profit in the transfer. Another way of doing this is using credit cards. You check with a credit card company and say, what's the exchange fee for using the credit card in a foreign country? And they're going to tell you. And there are certain cards that are designed for travelers. It's worth looking into. They have extra travel insurance on the credit cards, and their conversion rates are very friendly. But they might have an annual fee that goes with it. So when you convert your currency, there's always research that needs to be done, and people that travel a lot get really good at figuring out the best places to go with the lowest prices for their conversion. And we actually have to play some commercials so that Town Square can pay for the lights being on in here and pay for changing their soundboard and equipment a couple more times just to make it extra complicated. So if you would like to join the conversation, when we get back, the phone number in here is 254-773-1400, and we'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. Just to kind of sum up your question and our answer, let's make it simple. If you went to Canada right now and you had a dollar, and at the airport,
you're going to convert a dollar to a dollar.
You're going to convert your U.S. dollar to Canadian dollars. The official exchange rate closing at Friday's close was $1.3386 Canadian dollars per U.S. dollars. In reality, if you had a very low cost transfer going on and you had a low amount of money that you were dealing with, you'd probably get about $1.25 in Canadian money for every dollar in U.S. money you gave them. Because, again, like Jake said, they need to make it. That would be 8 cents on the dollar they were making as a profit. So you might want to shop around. By the way, if you do fly into a country, generally speaking, not always, but generally speaking, the airport exchanges are less advantageous for you than going to a bank.
Yeah, just think of them a little bit like the ATM in a bar. They're going to have a fee that will make your eyes water because they think everybody in a bar is going to want cash for some reason.
It could be.
Willing to pay for it and maybe slightly impaired in their judgment making.
Well, we're almost out of time for the first hour, and I did want to say something. We were talking about the stock market and inverted yield curves and inside outs and upside downs, and we can talk about the fact that housing sales are starting to slow and decline. The prices are declining in places. All this is bad news, but Barron's headline article today, which I tend to agree with, just like last year at this point, Barron's was saying in their headline article, the market's a little high, don't expect much growth next year.
That was last year.
That was last year. They're now saying that on the other side of this correction, they expect from maybe a 10% increase over the record we saw in 2018. Now, right now, that would be a 20% gain, but more conservatively, they're saying very comfortably for the year 2019, they would not be surprised to see a 10% gain in the market at some point. Now, then we can get into when is the next recession going to hit and PIMCO's comments about that came out on Friday, and we'll get into some other issues about when the next recession is going to hit. One thing we can say with a great deal of confidence is that recessions do come, and we are going to have another one
at some point.
And it's a matter of when, and in that speculation, but there's some warning signs that are out there that well in advance we can see that there is a probability of a recession. We can discuss that at length. But remember this, as a client recently emailed, who I've known for many, many years, and we flew in helicopters together, well, not physically together, but we were both flying helicopters
at the same time.
In
the air, yeah.
It's a fly-it-and-watch-it situation. There is no way to time the market. So, well, there may be a way to time the market, just nobody's ever found it. It seems so rational to look in retrospect and say, this is the time to get out of the market.
All you have to know is the future. That's all.
But the reason we don't try to do that is very simple. Nobody, and I mean to the best of my knowledge and deep research, nobody over the long term has been successful at market timing. They come up with these wonderful theories and ideas and wonderful ways of doing it and ultimately wind up broke. So they wind up losing money. And I watched a very, very astute market timer who used me as a broker many years ago go through a long period of trying to time the market, and he wound up after many years with less money than if he just stuck it in there and forgot about it. So that was the lesson I learned, and I haven't seen any evidence to go any other way. By the way, you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. We're about out of time for the first hour. We do have a second hour of our ramblings and meanderings on the dismal science coming up, so you're certainly welcome to give us a call at 254-773-1400 next hour. We also have another telephone number if you'd like to contact us off the air and tell us we're stupid, or maybe even
you could tell us that on the air too, but please be polite about it. Just politely call us. Sir, with all due respect, you're stupid.
And we are a wealth management investment advisory firm. We manage portfolios for people with higher net worth, and we do accept calls at 254-947-1111. There's a voicemail there on the weekends and real live people to answer the phone during the week. So it's 254-947-1111, or
you can reach that same voicemail real live people during the week toll free at 1-800-914-7526, 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, and we encourage it, thepersonalwealthcoach.com. We have copies and recordings of the radio program going back several years on there. We've got lots of newsletters to read through to see how accurate we've been in our prognostications and our informed guesswork. It's worth taking a look. So thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. You can go and email us directly at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com, and we actually read those things. So until next hour, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach. Thanks for listening.